everyone. Thanks for joining in for today's panel discussion titled Asia Pacific's True Test Begins Now. Can Digital Health Policies Deliver? This is the second Diagram Media Forum organized jointly by the World Editors Forum and Roche Diagnostics. So what lies ahead in digital health policy? The task ahead is really enormous and systems are still evolving. So I'm going to invite panelists on for the keynote address. I'd like to introduce Ms. Harjeet Gill, CEO APEC Med, to give a keynote address. She'll be sharing insights on the role of policymakers and how we can go about making the Asia-Pac region future ready.
Thank you, Shefali. So first of all, let me start by thanking the World Editors Forum and Roche, of course, for the opportunity today to do a short keynote. What I'd like to do before I actually give you some highlights of some of the work that we've been doing, I'd like to maybe introduce APEC Med. APEC Med is the only regional trade association for medical devices. And that we have over 200 members. And a lot of our members are the major med device companies globally, including diagnostics. And essentially, we work on issues that help promote faster access to healthcare. So we work in a variety of areas, whether it's digital health, regulatory, or advocacy, trying to work with our members and governments on the ground to move the needle when it comes to providing access to healthcare in this region. So today, what we're going to be doing is actually looking at a paper that we've developed in conjunction with A-Star Diagnostics Development Hub in Singapore. I think it's really important that the discussion today, we're able to talk about some suggestions that we can make around how governments and industry can collaborate to accelerate safe access to innovation, especially in digital health. So with this report, essentially what we have tried to do is, first of all, landscape digital health regulation in APAC. So you'll see some great best practices of countries and companies actually that are moving quite fast in this space. And secondly, as a panel, we'll maybe be able to discuss that later, is we suggest a framework for further discussion with policymakers in the region. We see this as very much as a journey. So of course, more pieces of work will follow, but I think this is a great first start that APEC Med, together with A-Star Diagnostics Hub, started last year. I think also for an association like us, it's a real privilege to be able to bring together key stakeholders in this discussion. And as a neutral body, I think discussions like this and platforms like this give us the opportunity to move that discussion forward. So what I'd like to do now is give you some highlights of the report. As I mentioned, the report focuses, first of all, in identifying some best practices around digital health regulation in the region and globally. And secondly, we then look at the framework. So when I look at best practices, I think there are three that I will focus on, and there are others in the report. So you know, the report is, of course, accessible to everybody here. I'd like to focus, first of all, on countries in this region. And some countries are actually making more progress than others, but three to highlight would be Australia, Japan, and Singapore, where there are clear protocols in place for a tailored regulatory review. And that's really important. It's important because for the rest of the region, these are good reference markets to take on board the learnings and actually start their own journey. The other best practice case that we highlight is Germany, and I think most of you here will be aware of the German Digi Fast Track process. So as a country, Germany has really made a big step towards enabling and accelerating digital health solutions. And I think this is a great example where, for example, digital solutions are given 1 year approval and reimbursement to build the clinical and longitudinal evidence they need to prove their solution. So that's another best practice highlighted in the report, which I think is interesting to read. And last but not least, Japan, where this Sakigake process actually cuts the review process down by 50%, following very much what the FDA has been doing also in the US. So these are three concrete examples. And as I've mentioned, there are more in the report. Obviously, today we can't go into the details of all of them, but they're good practices for us to learn from as a region and see where we can leverage some of those learnings. Now, taking those learnings, the second part of what we tried to do was actually focus on a framework, in suggesting a framework which can actually help regulators and policymakers in defining their own journey. That framework actually focuses on three areas. First is the qualification of software as a medical device. It's a fairly unclear area today in the regulatory space. And I think it's really important that the regulatory community, together with industry, are very clear on what is software as a medical device and have clear guidelines around what that means. I think the second area is also to support the rapid regulatory reviews, especially when you talk about software, you talk about updates, you talk about constant changes and learnings. So it's really important that for companies, for industry, for solutions out there, that the regulatory approvals in these cases is faster, and there are dedicated protocols and pathways set for that. And I think last but not least, the report focuses very much on how do you build, or at least suggests how can you build a process that allows you not only to collaborate, so collaborate with countries that may be reference markets, but also then how do you take those learnings and leverage them so that ultimately in Asia Pacific, we're able to have a more harmonized approach when it comes to regulatory approvals in digital health. So essentially, that is a brief summary of the report. As I mentioned, I'd like to thank ASTAR and John and the team for their collaboration here. We'll probably discuss in more details in the next 30 minutes or so some more elements of the report. But our Digital Health Committee at APAC Med actually started in 2019, and it couldn't have come at a more opportune time looking at the issues that we had to face during the pandemic. And one of the, of course, one of the key learnings during the pandemic is how digital health can help and support in a number of areas, whether it's rapid diagnostics or it's track and trace, remote monitoring. So I think we couldn't have actually come together at a more opportune time as a committee. And then having ASTAR as a partner to work with was really, really helpful.
Thank you, Harjeet. That was fabulous. You know, some of the insights that you brought up tells me that you're doing really pioneering work in this area. And as you were talking, there were lots of questions I wanted to ask. And I was like, you know, the World Economic Forum is hosting their Technology Governance Summit. And some of the issues that you brought up right now are going to be discussed as well there. So, this framework that you've come up with, do you think you could give a little bit more insight into what all it entails?
Yeah, so the framework is actually a collection of learnings. And I think those three key areas, if you look at digital health, the integration of software is, of course, the biggest challenge, right? Because you are combining a medical device with a digital platform. And obviously, the platform requires not only approval in terms of the information and the interactions that you have with patients. So we talk about many different areas that come into play, interoperability, we look at cybersecurity, we look at the protection of patient data. All of these things are very complex things to handle when you have a solution. So I think the important thing is, let's be very clear when we work with industry. So I'm now talking on behalf of, you know, the regulatory community. Let's just be very clear on the framework around those solutions. So that's why our report actually focuses in the area of software as a medical device. Be clear on the criteria, be clear on what is in and what is not, but also look at other areas, because it's not like a medical device that you can regulate once. I mean, this is a continuous journey with digital health because of the upgrades and the learnings around software. So I think in addition to having clear criteria and regulatory approval, you also need to have regulatory approvals that allow for a faster system that allows software updates and learnings to be approved. Because the last thing that you want is to have a solution and then, you know, it stops halfway. So it's a new space for all of us. I think we're all learning to navigate this. Not only how do you define the solutions, how do you prove some of the outcomes that these solutions are providing, but then also how does the regulatory industry then make sure that whatever solution is out there is safe, effective, but also updated.
And also there is this whole point about sharing that knowledge with several other countries, because in today's world, I think cross-border sharing of information is also becoming important. But before we go deeper into all these issues, let me invite Dr. John Thornback. He's the Chief Operating Officer of Diagnostics Development Hub in Singapore. And we're going to be discussing finding the balance in creating future-ready digital health ecosystems for our first panel, for our first panel discussion. Dr. Thornback.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Shafi. Yes, and welcome, everybody. I'm John Thornback. I'm Chief Operating Officer of the Diagnostics Development Hub here in Singapore. We are a national body of Singapore government. And we are tasked with creating a diagnostics and digital health ecosystem. And we do this basically by taking ideas and concepts from collaborating with companies to develop products. We actually productize it, what might be called a productization of an engine for both diagnostics. As you can imagine, we've been actively involved in COVID over the last year, and we've developed a whole number of diagnostics that have gone worldwide now in terms of distribution. And we're also actively involved in the digital health space as well. One of the things to remember about diagnostics is that, as I've always said, that diagnostics are only data anyway. That's what they provide to the doctor. So everything's digital, really, when you think about it. So even a regular in vitro diagnostic or an in vivo diagnostic is providing data. So everything is digital health in that concept. So bear that in mind. And that's a remit that we think about. So the Diagnostics Development Hub, we act as an interface with companies. We work closely with HSA. We help to talk to them about developing policy as well. And we help small companies to position their products so for regulatory approval as well. So we offer the complete package from concept to the registration. But we are a government body as well. So we are focused on what's good for Singapore as well, and what's good for the ASEAN region. One of the things that we do, we have initiated through the Intergovernmental Commission, is that we have an ASEAN DX initiative where we work with a number of the key labs in the ASEAN government areas, in the ASEAN countries, to really disseminate our information to help develop new products within the from the ASEAN ecosystem. I think we know that one of the big things in the ASEAN area is that in any data driven work, you need good cohorts. And I think that is, you need good data. And one of the challenges is that much of the data that is used to develop digital health products is developed in the West. Okay, comes from the West or from the USA. Therefore, it doesn't necessarily fit with the ASEAN population. And I think that one of the key things that Singapore has been involved in is building these data cohorts over the last 5 years. So, I mean, since 2011, when we had our electronic health record system was introduced in Singapore. But even in ASTAR and in the Singapore government, we've developed a whole series of different data sets, which are well curated, which allow us then to create digital health products for the ASEAN population. And I think that's very important to recognize as well.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, Dr. Thornback, especially on the point about getting data from the region before suitable applications can be made. I was at another conference on artificial intelligence, and we were talking about facial recognition systems. And a lot of the data in that field too is largely from the West. And they were using that data to come up with facial recognition systems in the East, which, you know, immediately as a journalist, it asks you to question, like, how accurate is that? And why are we even going further when the base is incorrect? But to come back to your own work that you're doing, I imagine it must have gone up so much in the past 1 year. And I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, how well have we been able to integrate digital solutions into trying to build a very sustainable health ecosystem in the last 12 to 14 months?
Well, I think Singapore has been actively developing a digital health ecosystem for quite a few years. In the last, what they call the RIE 2020, which is the five-year plan for development of the research infrastructure in Singapore, there was a key section and key focus on digital health, for instance, in terms of developing next generation diabetes risk management, in terms of wound care imaging processing. So you could develop imaging processes so you could anticipate how well wounds were healing. Of course, digital radiology, that's a major function now, which is now going to routine use. And one of the interesting programs was on personalization of hearing aids, which of course is digital as well, right? So, because digital can be image, it can be voice, it can be text, it can be biomedical data. So personalizing hearing aid is very interesting initiative. And going forward, the main focus is really in terms of building the number of digital health spin-offs, which is what we now have about 170 of those. And building, you know, and getting adoption and persuading, you know, that's the big key. We can invent, you can develop as many things as you want. It's adoption. It's funneling adoption into the main hospital systems, into the doctor surgeries, and into the patient management. That's the key. And that's the major focus, I think, going forward.
Talking to you, I get the feeling we're really at the beginning of this trend of trying to absorb and digital technology in the way we go about addressing healthcare needs.
Yes, we are. I mean, we're definitely at the beginning of that. You know, there's always been, doctors have always used multiple pieces of information to make a diagnosis. Right? That's, you know, the diagnostic test is one. Part of that, but the doctors have taken personal medical histories, et cetera, et cetera. What we're doing now is, you know, being able to integrate those in a smart way, such that that will improve the outcomes for the patients. And that's really important, how we take those data analytics and combine those and analyze those data analytics. And we can also apply, you know, AI tools, whether it's machine learning tools or the AI tools, to come up with multimodal ways of diagnosis of the patient. So you can do things, you know, make really personalized medicine becomes a reality. You can do many other things as well, you know. So looking at aging patients, for instance, and that we are living in an environment where the populations in general are aging. You know, how do you develop better treatment for the aging population? And you do that. You can do that through digital solutions, right? You can monitor the patient, the people when they're at home, so you can start to, for instance, you can do internet of IoT sensors in somebody's apartment that if they were substantially falling down, so you can actually see if they're falling down. If they've got Parkinson's, you can have sense. We've seen programs which have sensors, so you can actually detect how the patient is responding to the drug, the Parkinson's drug that they're on at the moment, and not just when they're in the doctor's surgery, but routinely, right? And these are digital health solutions that are then fed back in real time to the through good connectivity with the relevant data security tools to actually influence how the people who are aging, getting old, you want to keep them in their own homes as long as possible. You want to keep them healthy as long as possible. And these are the kinds of things which are becoming possible with digital health solutions, which are all being developed all the, you know, at the same time. It's not just high-tech medicine. It's really about going down to that level of being in the aging population, in people's homes, helping people to stay healthy much longer.
Yeah, and also I think one of the added benefits is that it reduces the pressure on healthcare systems. But I'm going to draw in Harjeet into this. And I was wondering, Harjeet, could you give us an Asia-Pac perspective? Where are we on this journey of trying to integrate our digital health systems as it's evolving into policies in this part of the world?
Yeah.
So that's of course the key question. And I think if you look at the examples that we use in the report, I believe that we've just started our journey. There's a lot more still to do. We're a very diverse region in Asia Pacific. So obviously some markets move faster than others. As I mentioned, markets like Australia, Singapore, Japan, clearly making good progress, especially when it comes to regulatory reform and accelerating digital solutions. And yet in ASEAN, we are just beginning that journey. And I think the important thing for me, though, is after COVID, having seen how that the pandemic has actually accelerated a number of digital solutions, these can really help to unlock access to healthcare in many of our markets. So it's even more important that we learn to work together. And I think the most important thing that a lot of the markets in Asia that we talk to are, I have to say, I'm very encouraged when I have these discussions, is the desire to learn, to learn from best practices, to look at what can be applied locally in their markets, or leveraging those learnings, and then looking, okay, so now where does this all converge, and how can I build on this? So I think that's essentially where we are in the journey. It's in different stages, in different markets. I think moving forward, important that we collaborate and try to harmonize some of these learnings.
I couldn't agree with you more, but looking at the potential impact that this can make, I'm just wondering what should be prioritized at the moment. And I'd like to invite both of you to share your remarks on this.
Ajit, do you want to go first?
Yeah, or
do you want me to go first?
I think in terms of prioritization, when we look at the region, and John mentioned it earlier as well, this is a massive region. It's 60% of the world's population. It's an aging population. And not only that, we have rise in NCDs. So there are many, many challenges that we will be faced with. And I think for me, prioritization has to be digital solutions that allow you faster access. So maybe in a number of Asian markets, we will step over installing some of the traditional infrastructures of healthcare and be able to move to healthcare systems that are actually simpler and faster. And that means digital health has quite a role to play. So if you look at COVID, a number of solutions in this region were actually, I think, instrumental in providing access. We look at telehealth, which probably the growth across the world, not only in Asia Pacific, was exponential. New models around remote monitoring, I think those sort of areas are also able to provide faster access to healthcare because you look at different care settings. So I think new solutions like that, that provide access that is more affordable and faster, is probably more important in terms of making sure that we're prioritizing these areas with governments. And then the last thing I want to say is, again, back to the point of learning from each other, we've got to be able to have the openness to collaborate.
Yes. Yes, I agree with that. And I think one of the very encouraging things that is happening is that what we see is the regulatory agencies talking to each other. And, you know, in ASEAN area, we've had the Medical Device Directive, which was set up in 2014 to harmonize regulation. And, you know, that's really created a level playing field for, so for anybody who, any companies that want to submit into the ASEAN region for a medical device, then there is a common submission document template. So you've got one process that you can do it, right? And that's the beginning part. It's not legally binding at the moment, but it's a start. And we have to apply that to if we can get that applied to and expanded to the digital health space as well, then you're opening up the whole of the 600 million people, the ASEAN market, to the best solutions available to them as rapidly as possible. And as Hajit said, that the whole aspect about alternative pathways as well is very important. Is how we with everybody now having mobile phones and internet connectivity pretty well throughout the whole of the region. Then we can start to monitor post-market performance, post-approval performance of our digital health solutions and products. And that means that you can get monitor what happens with the product as it's being used, then you can approve. The agencies are much happier to say, okay, we have a process now for monitoring post-market approval on much more rapidly. Therefore, you can change your digital health product within certain guidelines. And I think it's this: if we can in the future get harmonization of those kinds of regulations, that would be ideal for the whole industry. Such that, you know, you've got you get access to the data from different countries as well. You know, as we've seen with the vaccines, you know, the rollout as well, that once you get into millions of people, you do see things that you wouldn't necessarily see in small populations. So I think that with the digital health solutions, you know, with the ASEAN population, we go ahead and we roll out digital solutions, we will see much, and we have the same harmonized regulations and cross-recognition and cross-reliance on data. I think that will be very important going forward, and that will enable us to provide all our populations with the best possible solutions for their healthcare needs.
Can I just add to that? Because I think another area, and John triggered me during his comments, is I think also when you talk about prioritization, the whole area of capacity and capability building is important.
Yeah.
So we talk a lot about reference models. We talk a lot about harmonization. By the way, collaboration not only between countries, but also between industry and government, I think is important. But coming back to the point of increasing the capability and capacity in this region, I think that's a clear area where we need to invest. Because this, whether we're talking about medical devices or even digital health, these areas, healthcare is evolving in that sense quite fast. So it's really important associations like ours and others work with governments on the ground to support them in building the capability and capacity. Because without that, that's a big bottleneck in the whole system. So I think that's really key. That's really important as well.
Right. I mean, I have lots of questions coming to my mind. And one of them is, what is the receptivity to collaboration in the region? I'm really keen to know, especially in these COVID-19 times. But along with that, let me add in the issues of data security and privacy. I mean, that deserves priority too. So if you could share your thoughts on both these points, then we'd move on to the next set of questions.
Well, yes, I mean, you know, data security is paramount. You know, what we have to do is build confidence in our populations. You know, one of the things that you cannot have is leaks of people's personal data. That is the worst thing that can happen. It undermines people's confidence in what you're trying to do. It undermines everything you're trying to achieve to give them better healthcare. And that's paramount. And all the processes and all the work that is, there's many startups, there's many parts of government I know, and lots of companies working on this data security aspect. Because, and to be honest, with a lot of the development, you can use anonymized data. You can use it as you've got well-ordered cohorts, but you separate the data. You separate the data from the person. And therefore, you can use that data set to develop your products. And you can use that data set, but there has to be very strong borders and walls to stop any data leaks. And we've seen everywhere in the world has seen data leaks. And that's a constant battle that everybody is doing. But we have to have the highest standards for that. And that's all part of, you know, growing in this region as a digital health ecosystem and building products which suit our ASEAN population.
Yeah, maybe I can add to that. I think the first thing that interesting data point, obviously during COVID, there was a real increase in adoption of various digital solutions. I mean, people have been very, very protective about their own data, rightly so. But I think we've all probably been a little bit surprised at how fast, looking at the fight against the pandemic, how fast people have had to change their mindset and give their data so that they can be tracked and traced and you know, in many different areas. So I think that has definitely been a shift in mindset in consumers and patients alike. And it's probably more complex than that. I mean, it obviously only goes to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. I think back to what John was saying, this whole topic of, you know, how do you protect patient data is paramount and high on the agenda of all the med device companies that at least we deal with. It's very high on the agenda because any breach basically has a massive impact on the company as well, right? On the solutions that you provide, on the integrity and efficacy of the solutions that you apply. So I think a lot of effort is going on, especially within industry, to make sure that this is incredibly well managed and protected. As John mentioned, there are obviously leaks that have happened in many places, including Singapore. But the thing is, this is a new area, so we learn as well, and we learn and grow and get probably better at it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the way to go. There aren't very different approaches, but we are getting lots of questions from our attendees. And although I have my own questions, I'm going to move to the questions from our attendees first. What is the one thing Asia must do differently in this recovery phase for digital readiness and fast-tracking approvals? It's for both of you.
I can start with that, and I think we've mentioned it. Yeah. I think for Asia, it's about setting priorities on what will accelerate access. So I think ASEAN, different to what is happening in Australia, Japan, and Korea, but I think it's really important from a government body or government space to be able to identify what will unlock that access. And then I think as a regulatory community, the most important thing, the only way I believe we will be able to keep up with the speed and be faster to market in this is to learn from each other. So cherry pick what works out there, look at what fits your structure and systems, and make sure that, you know, you're open to collaborating. So we're already doing quite some work within APAC Med on you know, identifying reference markets for regulatory reliance. And I have to say the discussions have been actually moving really quite fast. So it's encouraging to see, but I think we will probably need more. And the last thing I would say is stronger collaboration between industry and government. So more discussions around what the challenges are, having a seat at the table to be able to contribute. And I think neutral bodies like APAC Med and many others have a good role to play there.
Great. Dr. Thorne, back, please.
Yes, I agree with that. And I think also, I think basically that the way forward is for the interaction of the regulatory agencies with the companies to be more to not be at the point when the product comes through. It should be when the product's been conceived, what we've identified as pre-submission discussions. And really what we're seeing now with the regulatory agencies is that they are being more proactive. They are coming out and asking companies and industry what's happening. They, especially in Singapore, I think, but also in other areas as well. And I think that it's a realization that to get better health here, it's a partnership. You know, the regulatory agencies traditionally have been, okay, how do we protect the healthcare of the nation? But it's now much more of a partnership with the industry, I think. And the more we can build those partnerships, the better going forward. And one of the ways in terms of the digital health space, it will be in terms of how do we adapt the regulations to suit the dynamic nature, as Haji said, of the way in which digital health solutions modify and change as they get more data in. And how do you control that? And there are ways of doing that. And there are models now which are being developed both in industry and in collaboration with the regulatory agencies. The US has done a lot of work on this. There are other bodies as well. Singapore's issued some guidelines as well. Australia, Japan has issued some very good guidelines as well. So these solutions are beginning to occur, and they're beginning to be developed, and we are making real progress. And it's the digital health is now already adopted in many areas that people probably don't realize, except that, you know, the simple things like you do your consultations online with your GP these days. Because of COVID, how many people ever went to a GP? Most people would do their consultations over a telephone, right? That's now common in certainly in Singapore. So we are moving very quickly, but it's going to the next level, I think.
To me, when you talk about flexibility and being agile as far as regulatory health systems are concerned, you know, if you go away from Singapore, even in Asia, I think it's a very, very complex issue, and change happens very, very slowly.
I'm not sure it is happening slowly. I mean, you know, you saw Thailand has also announced digital health initiatives. You know, it's happening, and because the digital health solutions are not necessarily, as Haji said, they don't necessarily involve massive infrastructure. You know, they can be developed with the right regulatory controls, with the right development processes. They can be developed relatively cheaply, but make big impacts on patient health. So these are available to a population as we have in ASEAN and in Asia, which is a very high, you know, it's a very IT savvy population. I mean, you know, people in my group, they do things with their mobile phones that I couldn't even conceive of, right? But I'm just an old guy, right? So, you know, it's not, and that's a very simple thing. And take it the next stage further in the developers. It's not multi-million dollar packages that need to be developed that cost as you would to develop a big machine. There is lots of opportunities in smaller areas by local ASEAN and Asian companies and organizations and people and entrepreneurs to develop real digital health solutions and have them. The challenge is how you get them in use. And I think that's the next challenge that we'll have, right? You know, I think we can develop them. I think we can get them regulated. And I think that's the first. The next thing is how do we get how do we get them adopted? Great. And I think that's that's going to be a challenge over the next few years. You know, we've got, as I said, you know, hundreds of health tech startups all over Asia, in every country, in all the countries in the ASEAN public. But the question is, how are we going to get that technology adopted? And I think that's the challenge of going forward. for me anyway. That's what.
Especially when you talk to your parents and people in the interiors of any country, then there is a reluctance to do that. I'm going to invite Mr. Arun Goyal to share his experience from India, and he has a question for Harjeet as well. He can raise it right here.
Thank you, Jovani. So question to Harjeet was, Harjeet, you were mentioning about capacity building and you were emphasizing initiative on the capacity building. We in India, let me first introduce myself first. I'm part of National Digital Health Mission and I am driving the National Digital Health Mission at NHA through IQVIA. I am project director there. And we are working on a project for India-wide, developing a digital health system there. In that capacity building, as you mentioned, I would like to know the, what areas you are focusing and could be the area of focus where we can build the strategy accordingly. That was the one thing, one question. Later, I'll come up for more.
Okay, Arun, nice to meet you. Actually, we've done a lot of work with IQVIA in the past as well. So happy to discuss offline what more we can do. So sure. One of the key priorities for APAC Med has been within our regulatory committee, how do we build capacity capability within the regulatory ecosystem? This is a project actually that APAC Med started way before I even joined, and I've been with APAC Med now. This is my second year. So with various partners, and we've worked with Accenture, we've worked with Deloitte, partnering with AHWP, we've come up with a framework of skill set. So how do you basically make sure that there is a standardized framework for training the regulatory industry and community? So it's both on the industry side and on the government side. And we spent a lot of time actually researching on what would be the key skill sets in making a framework that actually highlights the key areas of training that we would need to do. We're now in our third year, because it's taken a while to do this study, so we're now in our third year. The first year we looked at industry, the second year we looked at government, and this year is the year that we're actually going to be developing a curriculum. So actually taking the work that we have done, using the framework and the key skill sets that are needed, and then develop a curriculum with a partner to be able to take it in market. So this year will be development of the curriculum, and next year we'll probably look at how we roll that out. And typically we do that then in partnership with a number of trade associations on the ground. Actually, in India, we have our country leader for APAC Med, Anirudh Sen. He joined us, a year ago this month. And he's been already doing a fantastic job in seeing how you make it fit for purpose for India. Because, of course, you can have a framework, but each country has some specific challenges. And there are obviously some common challenges. So I think India will actually be one of the first markets that we roll out the training, because they're one step ahead when it comes to developing the curriculum. So happy to share more on that. I mean, as I said, it's a key priority for us, because I think definitely looking at the role we play within the industry, this is a clear gap. So if we can bring industry and government together to share learnings and to build the capacity around regulators, then yeah, it will all help in the end. And it's not a fast journey, it's a long journey, but I think it's good at least to have a common platform from which to work.
Thank you. Shefali, you are on a mute, if you are speaking.
Okay, we have lots of questions coming in. Here's one from SCMP on vaccine passports, which I'm sure a lot of us want to know your views on. The question is this: what are the ethical and privacy concerns on vaccine passports? And is global equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines the prerequisite for vaccine passports?
I'll let John go with that.
Oh, clearly I've got to speak as an individual, right? And this, I cannot speak for anything else, right? I think that's a very difficult question. I think that, you know, there are for me, there, as I say, I'm speaking as a just as a person. I think that there are potentially issues around passports and restricting people based on that. Although we do restrict access depending on vaccination already into some countries. If you haven't got vaccinated for certain diseases, you won't get access to a country if you're visiting, for instance. That's a slight. So we do have vaccine passports to some extent. You know, if you want to, I remember going to Nigeria and we had to have, yellow fever and typhoid injections before certification we could go. And that's still true, I'm sure. So there are already vaccine passports as such. Whether how we would handle that for everybody, I think it's very difficult because some people are, cannot be vaccinated. You know, we have people here in my organization who have allergies, and are therefore, are have underlying disease. So therefore they cannot be vaccinated. Well, I don't believe we should be restricting their rights to movement. So I think it's a very, very difficult question. I think a one that is the politicians are going to have to balance out, I think. Sorry to be equivocal on that, but it is something that I don't think it's a scientific question. I think it's more a political question.
Yeah, and I agree, but I have to say, for me, like John, I mean, I answer on a personal level. I think the first part of the question is the key issue. How do we ensure equitable access for everybody to the vaccine? And that's still a journey that we're on. I mean, even in regions or countries where there is access, you see that the rollout is happening in different stages, right? I mean, look at the EU and the UK, for example. So I think it's a new area for us. At least it's the first pandemic I have experienced in my lifetime, and I'm well over 50. So I think, that's the first thing. We're having to navigate already this journey globally. So politically, I can't answer that, but I think definitely that's the first question to be solved. How do we ensure access to the vaccine for all? And then the second question is, of course, what economies will open up faster? In fact, we had a very interesting session this morning on another paper that APACMED worked with LEK on, which is, the role of COVID-19 vaccines and testing, and how can that accelerate the opening of, or coming up with scenarios where, doing this can help, especially some of the countries in our region, open up faster. So what were the learnings in other parts of the world? And I think there, each country probably has its own policy. And I'm just hoping that eventually there is a level playing field again, if ever there was one, but at least more so in dealing with the pandemic. And I fully expect as a, when I travel personally, that I'm going to have to be able to share and show whether I've been vaccinated or not. And there's a lot of ethics around that as well, authentic and how regulated is the passport that you have as well, because it also opens up a massive world of other areas that we don't want to go into. So, yeah, difficult question, probably not one that we're able to answer here or debate here in such depth.
Absolutely. And I can see so many questions coming in. So I'm going to quickly move to take as many as possible. We've got one from the Jakarta Post. What do you see as the biggest obstacle in developing digital health ecosystems, and how countries in Asia Pacific can move in the same direction to capitalize on opportunities and initiate a positive digital transformation?
Maybe I can kick off. I think, the biggest obstacle that I see personally, and John alluded to this, there are many, many startups in the region that are disrupting healthcare. providing digital solutions that will give better access, cheaper access. Adoption is key. So adoption and reimbursement, I would say, are probably two key areas that prevent us from scaling these issues. I think when it comes to adoption, we talk, how do you integrate them into the continuum of care? So when you look at a patient's journey, it's many steps in many different stages of their life. But today, everything is very siloed. So I think we've really got to look at putting the patient at the heart of the solution and then see how is it that we can, as an industry, playing in different parts of that ecosystem, connect with the patient seamlessly. And that's a massive challenge. How do you pass on, you know, and many patients who have one chronic disease will have another one. So, you know, I think the important thing is how do we then, back to collaboration, how do we collaborate better together and manage that patient in a seamless way? So I think that definitely for me is still a major hurdle in terms of scaling and integrating digital solutions. And those two words for me are important. And then the second thing is reimbursement. I mean, still we're working with, you know, healthcare investment in this region, which is less than 5% of GDP. Whereas we need to step up on investment. We need to start as a region in certain parts of this region, we need to start investing more in healthcare. So reimbursement of certain solutions and, you know, and things like, you know, telemedicine make primary care much, and it's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination yet, but at least it makes certain parts of your healthcare journey simpler and easier and potentially cheaper. If you also look at remote care monitoring, that can be much cheaper if it's done in different settings like the home. So easier then to reimburse as well. So I'd say those two things. John, I'll hand over to you. I've actually forgot the second question. What was the second question?
The second question is basically like, how do countries in Asia Pacific move in the same direction to maximize the opportunities?
Well, I'll let John answer first and then I'll come back.
Yeah. Okay. I think the key is what digital health potentially offers us is better health, as Hajid has said. If it is disruptive, there are elements of digital health which are disruptive. So therefore, there may be some opposition to the change. But there are, in many cases for digital health, the opportunity. The disruption will be a cheaper, more long-term opportunity in terms of the quality of the healthcare. You know, as Hajit has said, you know, remote monitoring at home of people. Everybody has a mobile phone these days, right? So even in our region, and that will increase, and therefore they can monitor their things at home. You know, getting better solutions and better diagnostic solutions, where, for instance, the data can be read on a mobile phone and then submitted to the doctor. So you can do a test. You don't have to go travel a long way to a hospital. It can be done by a nurse, a traveling nurse in a small community. You can improve that. So the adoption is about how it will, in the end, one, give better healthcare for everybody, even the poorer of the society, but two, also save money in the long term, you know, because you say, you know, and also increase the economy, because if people don't have to travel distances to hospital, wait around the hospital all day, come back just for one test and waste a whole, you've lost all that economy for somebody and probably their family as well. And if you can keep people in their communities with digital health solutions where they're transferring data and you've got both diagnostics and potentially, you know, vaccinations and digital health monitoring, you have created a new healthcare paradigm in this region, which could, for the governments, see a way of maximizing the revenue they can put into healthcare, rather than saying, I'm not going to say they decrease the amount of money they put in, but maximizing the benefit of the money they put in. they can physically put in. And I think that's a powerful message that will aid adoption of new digital health solutions. That's all.
And just to come, sorry, Shefali, just to come back to the second question about the region, actually, and this, I didn't intend to make a plug for this, but I will do. Asia, APAC Med is holding a digital symposium on May the 4th. And this is exactly the question that we're discussing. So how can Asia move faster? How can we transform faster when it comes to digital health? So we're going to do a series of digital symposiums where we bring experts from all over the world to talk about what is working and where the gaps are in Asia, and then how can we work together. So the first of these symposiums is on May the 4th. And the interesting question here is, actually the interesting point I want to make, first of all, is we looked globally for best practices. So digital solutions that have been implemented and integrated into a healthcare system end to end. And I think we found maybe 10, 15, very few that have actually worked end to end. So it's very much a new space. I think taking learnings from those sort of solutions that have been identified, that have been proven and then reimbursed and then adopted, it's really important that we open ourselves up in this region to do that and then come up with a way of what we can do in this region. If I look at Asia Pacific, I mean, the gaps are there, right? And it's not just our region. I mean, the gaps are everywhere. So, yeah.
In fact, I want to ask you, how does Asia relate to the West? But I'm going to hold back because we have really one other interesting question on misinformation that's come up, and I want to raise it before you. And it goes like this. After one emergency use approval to another, how should regulatory agencies guarantee the safety of vaccines to the public to effectively establish their credibility on digital spaces, given the misinformation on their efficacy and effectiveness that is so prevalent?
Okay, also a very difficult question. And to be quite honest, I'm not so deeply into the IVD space as a number of other panelists. We represent medical device industry across the board. But I think it's, so first of all, I would say, first of all, I think the release of any medical device or vaccine or whatever you want to call it, it's got to be done safely and it's got to be done efficaciously, right? So I think that's why there's no fast cut to regulatory approvals. That's not what we're asking. We're not saying speed should compromise safety ever. But I think we can be faster as an industry. So that's the first thing. And that's where I come back. And together with John, we've spoken a lot about what do we learn with each other. I think healthcare is not the only industry where there's a lot of misinformation and mistakes that are being made. And I tend to be quite strict with that, but also practical. So I think we're learning. And the important thing for me in this whole journey is that we are able to learn from the mistakes that we make. So misinformation on a global level is difficult to manage, as we've all seen because of social media. But I think as an industry, we just really need to be always very, very conscientious with what we do, what we learn, who we collaborate, and how we sort of integrate all of these learnings into whatever processes that we have. I mean, at a very high level, that's what I would say.
John?
So I'm not trying to add very much more to that, but I think we're all prone to getting misinformation. And one of my other roles is as head of QA and biosafety at one of the big government COVID testing labs. And, you know, we have people in my group who said, I don't want to be vaccinated. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, you know, because I've read this on the internet. I said, you know what, you know, you're scientists. So it's very difficult to stop misinformation these days. And it just requires you to be rigorous in the science and in the decisions you make, and be very honest. You know, science is something that does have abnormalities in it. It's not cut and dried all the time. In fact, it's never cut and dried. And people have to understand that. And you just have to be, as they've said all the way through the COVID, you just have to go with the peer-reviewed science. That's the one we test. That's the one we trust. It's peer-reviewed science by people who understand in detail what the results say and the implications of them are. And that's the only way we can protect against that, is being very rigorous, all of us, in terms of the way in which, if you're journalists, you respond to, you see an article that says, this has gone wrong. Well, you're very rigorous in checking. And that's the classic journalism process, right? And it's the same with scientists. We have to check and recheck and recheck again. And that's the important thing. And that's the only way we're going to get around misinformation. But you'll never eliminate misinformation. Unfortunately, we live in an era where misinformation can happen in 10 seconds globally because it goes through Twitter or something. And it's very difficult then to pull it back. But just be very rigorous. That's the issue of it. Just be very rigorous, very, very honest and very rigorous. Hiding stuff doesn't work. Nobody should be doing that. It's something in any science, you should not hide things.
And if you would allow me to add to that, I would say we should have many more discussions like this, because that allows the flow of knowledge to happen, and that itself leads to an improvement in the credibility on any complex issue. But thank you so much for your time. That was really interesting, engaging.